On the program today, the importance of the trend line in economic statistics. Ignore it at your peril, folks. VR at South By, and another story from our economic poll. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, the 17th of March. Glad, as always, to have you with us, everybody. The usual caveat applies here. The Dow does not equal the economy and all that. Don't make me repeat myself. But it is worth a note that after the shaky first 10 weeks of the year that we have had, the Dow turned positive for the year this afternoon. Also today, there was cheer to be found in a number we don't usually report. First-time claims for unemployment benefits were up just a hair for the week. They are a weekly number. There's volatility in that, so we don't usually report it. But the long-term trend of jobless claims, which, with all economic numbers, is what you really want to watch, has been low for almost a year now. Marketplace's Nova Sappho explains what this number tells us about the American economy.
Here's a disquieting fact from Gary Burtless, an economist at the Brookings Institution.
Almost all recessions take most professional forecasters by surprise.
Burtless says there is one important reliable indicator. You guessed it, weekly jobless claims.
The last couple of recessions have been preceded by a suspicious increase in new claims for unemployment benefits.
The good news is that we've seen no big increase in those claims. The latest weekly numbers are up slightly, but the total, 265,000 new jobless claims, is still low, and it's been holding steady for almost a year.
It is a very good statistic. It shows that layoffs are at extremely low level.
Gad Levinon is the chief North American economist at the Conference Board.
It's one of the best leading indicators of employment that suggests that the labor market and employment are on the right trajectory.
Levinon says with employers showing no signs of slowing down their hiring, even wage growth is likely to accelerate over the next year or two. If you've been waiting for the big caveat, here it is. Yes, jobless claims held steady. That's good. But the bad news is that they held steady.
There's evolution going on, not a revolution where things are suddenly changing.
Michael Montgomery of IHS Global Insight says there's no big growth in employment or the economy, and that makes us vulnerable to sudden shocks.
There's no obvious thunderclouds, but the sky's a little overcast.
Montgomery says keep an eye on that jobless claims number to signal storm clouds ahead. In Chicago, I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
Three words, you decide, Chipotle Mexican Grill. Sales are down, share prices down, foodborne illnesses are the proximate cause, of course. The company differentiated itself, as you know, by selling food made fresh right in front of you. But now, Chipotle is going to be preparing more food at central facilities instead of on-site. Marketplace's Annie Baxter looks at that change and Chipotle's brand identity.
It's called brand DNA. Marketing expert Carlos Torelli at the University of Minnesota says it's the unique thing a company offers.
If you think, for instance, Disney, you know, it's family entertainment. If we think, for instance, Nike, we think superior athletic performance. So if we think Chipotle, then we think natural and fresh.
But in the wake of foodborne illness outbreaks, the way Chipotle is delivering fresh is changing. Some produce is now prepped at central kitchens instead of in restaurants. Beef barbacoa and pork were already cooked off-site, but now the steak will be too. Torelli says it's not clear if those changes will compromise the fresh taste and fresh brand.
What's the turnaround time? How many central locations are serving different restaurants, and you know how quickly they bring it, how much does the flavor suffer in that process?
At a conference yesterday, Steve Ells, founder and co-CEO of Chipotle, said the safety measures are actually making the food taste better. The steak, for example, he says it'll be pre-cooked with a method used by top chefs called sous vide.
And the result is the steak is more tender.
But to get people in the door eating, say, steak burritos, Chipotle admits it's giving away a lot of free food. And that's concerning to Steven Anderson, a restaurant analyst at Maxim Group.
I think that probably more than anything else might send a damaging brand message that their burritos may not be worth much.
Plus, giving away food for free or at steep discounts is expensive, and he worries how long the strategy will last. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
All right, here's the quote of the week. It's from the world's biggest private sector coal company. Begin quote, "We may not have sufficient liquidity to sustain operations," end of quote. That suggests Peabody Energy may be the next big coal company to go bankrupt and declare Chapter 11, and it must be said that that chapter is pretty full as the coal mining business goes through what one analyst calls its hour of reckoning. Marketplace's Scott Tong is on the story from the Sustainability Desk.
Here's the difference 5 years makes. In 2011, Peabody Energy stock flew over 1,000. It bet big on mine purchases in Australia, says analyst Christopher Inton at Morningstar.
It paid full price for these, and they used a lot of debt to do so. That's basically the debt that they're dealing with now. You buy something at the peak market, use a lot of debt, and the market collapses.
Now, coal prices have fallen 60%, and Peabody stock is down to 2. The commodity bust has withered demand. U.S. production could hit a 30-year low, says the Energy Department, which also thinks cheap natural gas will surpass coal for the first year ever. And Peter Marsters at the Rhodium Group says there's a more hidden problem, a shrinking China market for a type of coal that makes steel. It's more profitable.
It's just worth a lot more. So any decline in that market will have a comparatively greater impact on a lot of these companies' revenues.
Many analysts think the firms in bankruptcy will shrink, but they won't go away. But some of their financial obligations could. In court, at least one big company has canceled health insurance payments to retirees. Another is trying to do something similar. Andrew Cosgrove is with Bloomberg Intelligence.
It's kind of a back and forth where they say, okay, we'll chop part of the pension obligations off and, you know, rework the labor contract so you guys can keep your jobs, the company can continue to run.
Then there's a question of cleaning up mines when they shut down. For now, most are still open during bankruptcy. The question is, who holds the bag if a company liquidates? I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Green all the way around in equities today. Fitting, right? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Elsewhere in commodities news, not oil, not gold, not, I don't know, pork bellies, but cotton. Lots and lots of cotton. A couple of years ago, the Chinese government started buying up cotton by the millions of bales full to put a floor under weak prices and support its farmers. Didn't work. Prices kept falling, which means Beijing couldn't sell all the cotton it had for fear of taking a bath. So now they've got piles of the stuff, big piles of it. Lucy Kramer wrote about China's cotton stockpiles in the Wall Street Journal. We got her on the line from Hong Kong on Skype. Hi, Lucy.
Hi, how are you going?
I'm well, but you have to help me understand why China has all this cotton.
Well, China had started a policy back in March 2011 where they started buying cotton. It was an effort to improve prices for domestic cotton farmers. They set a price floor for the cotton. And over the 3 years that they ran the program, cotton prices globally fell. And so it wasn't a market for them to on-sell that cotton. As a result, they stockpiled it. It's been in warehouses in China since then. And now they're looking to sell it.
Give me a sense of scale. How big is this? Well, it's probably several giant piles of cotton, but how big is it?
Okay, I think the best way to know is it would make you 10 billion pairs of jeans.
Wow.
So that's a lot of pairs of jeans that people need to buy before we're going to be able to get rid of all that cotton out there.
And they're looking to sell it, I guess, quickly, because the thing about cotton is that you can't leave it sitting in a warehouse for too long because it rots.
It's hard to know how long cotton's actually going to last in a warehouse because it does depend a lot on the humidity and how damp it is, how it's being stored. So we've got a while before that becomes a real issue, but it can't stay in that warehouse forever.
You write in your piece that this stockpile that the Chinese have is something like 60% of the global stockpile. So what happens if they start selling it off to, the price of blue jeans and cotton worldwide?
Well, for starters, it's important to note that this cotton isn't probably going to end up on the global market. However, China makes up about 30% of global cotton consumption. So if Chinese producers are using this cotton rather than cotton from elsewhere, it means that there just isn't the demand there. We're already starting to see that in the global cotton prices. Cotton is trading down about 8% this year in the US. So it's going to have a huge impact as we go forward.
Do you suppose that if I go to the store in 6 months after China has started selling off this stockpile, if I go to the store, am I going to be able to get a pair of blue jeans for, you know, $10 less or something?
Yeah, you might. The cotton prices for things like jeans might come down over the coming months. Things for synthetic yarn is down as well. So there's lots of kind of reasons that your jeans might start becoming a bit cheaper.
Lucy Kramer for the Wall Street Journal in Hong Kong talking about cotton. Lucy, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Down Austin, Texas way, the big South by Southwest Interactive Festival is rolling over into South by Music. The tech portion of the conference, though, now the biggest portion, should you be interested, is a place where hot, if sometimes niche, trends in tech go to become mainstream. The hot, if niche trend this year is virtual reality. Marketplace tech host Ben Johnson has pulled the tough duty. He's been in Austin all this week, so we called him up to talk about VR. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Kai.
So give me the virtual reality experience there. I imagine it's all over the place down there.
It is all over the place, Kai. Almost every party that I've been to, not that I'm just partying, but all the parties, all the events down here, almost every single one has some kind of virtual reality happening there. And there are lots of different kinds of VR experiences that are happening. I mean, Samsung had this big space across from the convention center here. They were strapping people into rumble couches that would bounce you around and make you feel like you're riding a Six Flags roller coaster. People are wearing this Oculus Rift headset. It's everywhere.
All right, so here's what I want to know, though. You remember in 2000, what was it, 7, Twitter went to South By, and that was their really big breakthrough thing. And then, like, 2009, 2010, Twitter got big. You remember that?
Yep, I do.
Is this virtual reality's year, and then in 3 years, we're all going to have this on our sets at home?
I think that is sort of, at least the people who come to South By and think that it's an influential event, that's the hope, right? Is that you get to see something a couple of years early here. And I think that you could make that argument. Certainly, it's all over the place. And it's really being used by all different kinds of companies and organizations. You know, South by Southwest, which is, as you know, Kai, all about hashtag brands. this is something that where a lot of brands are playing with this. The PGA Golf Tour, which isn't exactly known for being like the hippest, most millennial-friendly yeah. event in the world, was here talking about virtual reality and giving fans an intimate look at pro golfers' first-person experience on the fairway. But I think it's still really experimental, Kai. There's no killer app yet for VR, right. But VR itself might be a kind of killer app for companies to market themselves, and I think that's what we're seeing.
Did I see somewhere in my reading on this that McDonald's is doing virtual reality? You got to help me with that. That's crazy.
Okay. Yeah, this was certainly one of the most initially confusing VR experiences, Kai. The company had this big space. They were using headsets made by HTC, which most people probably know as a phone company.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because these headsets, as you're wearing them, you can actually move around the space you're in, and your movements get tracked by these other little cubes that are watching you with this headset on. You have two hand controllers, and in the McDonald's experience, they actually put you inside a massive McDonald's Happy Meal box and let you use the controllers to paint the inside of the box. You can shoot paintballs. You can paint with lasers or this kind of 3D brush that suspends the paint in the air around you. Again, not sure what the value proposition there is, Kai, but it just seems like there's a coolness factor here that McDonald's and a lot of other companies want to be a part of, and VR is the cool thing in tech right now.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech. He's been down in Austin at South by Southwest all week. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up.
Having left the bank, I had a chance to think and reflect, and I think my thinking has evolved.
Lord Mervyn King, kind of like Janet Yellen, except he's a Brit. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials climbed 155.9%, ended at 17,481, back, as I said, in the black for this year. The NASDAQ added 11.2%, 4,774. The S&P 500 up 13.6%, 2,040. Hey, you been to Famous Dave's lately? Barbecue for all, yeah? Famous Dave's of America, ticker symbol DAVE, up 0.8% today. You drinking green beer at Famous Dave's right now? First of all, don't do that. But this is the day for Guinness. It's owned by Diageo, based in London. Diageo up 0.2%. Are you having a Jameson whiskey, perhaps? Owned by Pernod Ricard of Paris, France. Pernod off 0.4%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 1.89%. I love my job. You're listening to Marketplace.
Need your Marketplace fix on the go? You can listen anytime, anywhere on your mobile device or online. You can find us on iTunes, Slacker, TuneIn, and more. Or download the Marketplace mobile app and never miss the numbers.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. So we started today with a number, that report on first-time claims for unemployment. Here's another one from the new edition of the Marketplace Edison Research poll that we're rolling out this week. 59%. That's the proportion of Americans who said it would be very or somewhat difficult to pay an unexpected bill of $1,000. And if you think about it, you could get a bill for $1,000 before you know what's going on. Could be almost anything. And the numbers are even more troubling for African Americans and Hispanics, who are more likely not to have savings or investments to fall back on. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams brings us this story of where people go when they're out of options.
If you're struggling to buy food or pay for childcare, even pay rent, there are services to help. But say your car breaks down or your kid chips a tooth and needs a dentist and you need cash. A lot of times, says Mersa Baradaran, you're just out of luck.
Your survey shows exactly how that comes to fruition.
Baradaran wrote a book called How the Other Half Banks, about limited financing options for the poor.
And what it means for people when they face emergencies and how thin of a financial buffer some folks have that create really, really problematic, sharp edges to their lives.
She says since so many people are living so close to the edge, one emergency expense can push them over. Baradaran says that's especially true for minorities.
African Americans and Hispanics have been left out of professional jobs for many years through racism. And also, you know, recently I think racism is less to blame and it's more just systemic poverty.
In Los Angeles, some of the folks that need help land at a community service organization called Lyft. It directs its clients, the group calls them members, to things like housing and food assistance. Lorraine Perales works there and says a $1,000 expense would be impossible for most of them.
With our members, even with myself, I mean, that's a big amount. If they work paycheck to paycheck as is, it's a difficult thing.
Perales speaks fluent English and Spanish, catering to Lyft's many Hispanic clients. Almost three-quarters of the Hispanics in our poll said it would be tough to come up with a grand. Those numbers are even worse for African Americans.
¿Y qué ahorita cómo se está sintiendo él? ¿Está en la casa?
No, está en la escuela.
¿Está en la escuela?
Sí.
Sí.
38-year-old Iris Enriquez is a single mom. She has two kids and works 10 to 12 hours a day. Last year, a paperwork mix-up caused her to lose her food assistance and her job cut her hours. That put her behind on rent.
Estaba preocupada porque me iban a sacar de mi vivienda.
So she said that she was really worried because she was going to be evicted. So she tried looking for people to help her, her friends or other family members that she knew of, and they weren't able to help her for the rent.
Of the people in our poll who said it would be hard to pay an unexpected expense, half said they didn't have a friend or family member they could turn to for help. But just as Enriquez was about to be evicted, Lyft was piloting a program to provide cash for emergencies. They called around and scrounged up enough money to cover a month of rent.
Feliz. Lloré. Lloré, yeah.
So she said that she felt very, very happy. She came and she didn't know that she was going to get any help with her rental assistance, and she cried. And until now, she's still crying. So I'm a little teary myself, but so she's very happy and she's very, very grateful.
Having that place to stay let Enriquez get a second job, and now she's working on building her savings. She comes to Lyft every Thursday morning for financial counseling. But she still feels like she's barely holding on to her financial security.
Nervous. Yeah, nerviosa.
On this visit, she's worried about another unexpected expense. One of her kids broke his finger the day before, and she had to take him to the emergency room. She didn't know how much it was going to cost or how she was going to pay for it. In Los Angeles, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
There are all kinds of good tidbits in our new poll. Here's one of my favorites. Almost one out of every three Americans say they lose sleep because of their financial situation. Think about that just for a second. All the results are on our website, as is the latest update to our Economic Anxiety Index. And tell you what, do us a favor while you're there. Take a second and do our quiz. See where you fall on the economic anxiety curve. It's all, of course, at marketplace.org. We heard yesterday on this program from Janet Yellen, the chair of the Federal Reserve, the sitting chair of the Federal Reserve, I should say, which is to say that she's kind of got to watch what she says, right? Lest we all freak out, right? Mervyn King has no such restrictions. Lord King, as he was titled after he left office, was for 10 years the governor of the Bank of England, 10 years that saw the run-up to and the full-blown effects of the financial crisis and the recession. And he says we are not out of the woods yet. He says it in his new book. It's called The End of Alchemy. Lord King, welcome to the program.
Very pleased to be with you.
Let me start, sir, with the title of this book, which does kind of jump off the cover. The End of Alchemy, you have called it, which does imply, that word alchemy, something not necessarily on the up and up.
Well, alchemy was always converting base metal into gold, something that wasn't very valuable into something that was. And our monetary and banking system also has an element of this with bank deposits, which people believe they can always take out when they want. But in fact, if everyone tried to take the money out of the bank, it wouldn't be there. That paper money or even electronic money depends on the trust of the government or issuer of that currency. It isn't all quite what it seems. Mm.
You say basically that the people at the heart of the financial crisis in 2008 and 2009 were fundamentally good people, but running a system that was built on bad ideas. What were the bad ideas then?
I think the first bad idea was to believe that the global economy or even the U.S. economy was just going steadily on an ever upward path with occasional blips up and down. But in fact, it wasn't like that. We were moving into quite a serious disequilibrium. And we've got ourselves into a position where it's become increasingly difficult for central banks to stimulate spending in the economy.
All right. So we'll get to the future and the answers in a second. But I want to back you up because, and I say this with all due respect, you were running one of the three or four most important central banks on the planet while this was going on. And now, 5 years after the crisis, you've come out with this book. Where were you when you were in a position to do something about it, sir?
Well, I was talking and giving speeches about what I called the paradox of policy during the crisis. I said in 2008 and 2009 that we could not carry on with this monetary stimulus indefinitely, that it was fine as a short-term stimulus, but it wouldn't be the answer to our long-term problems. Indeed, nobody involved in this actually had any incentive to take actions themselves, whether it was bankers who were taking too much risk with high leverage or in getting involved in very complex securities. If any bank had opted out of all that 5 years before the crisis hit, I doubt that the senior executives would have got through to 2007 without being fired because they would not have made the profits that other banks were making. Mm-hmm. And equally, any central bank that said, well, hang on a minute, interest rates are just going down and down. This cannot be the right long-run answer. If any one central bank had decided to put up interest rates, well, it certainly would have caused a downturn, probably a recession in their own economy, but it would have made no difference to the likelihood of a global recession.
Let's stick in the present here for a minute. This recovery, while it has been long and it has been steady, it has been underperforming, I guess you could say. And I wonder why you think that is.
Well, I think it's pretty clear what the answer isn't. This isn't the case that the recovery is slow because we're just facing another headwind, which is going on a bit longer than we had expected. We need to shift the structure of our economy to a new equilibrium, and the US and the UK has to export more and shift away from consumer spending as a reliance for our growth. And Germany and China have to do the opposite. And we have to get to a point where people are willing to save and willing to invest when interest rates go back to a more normal level.
Acknowledging that this is only a half an hour radio program, sir, how are you going to do that?
I think in the longer run, there are probably three things we need to do. One is collectively around the world to recognize that we need exchange rates to move and be more flexible than was the case in the past 20 years. I think the second thing we need to do, and I know it's easy to say, but I do think it's central to where we are now, is to boost productivity. And the third thing we need to do is to recognize that one of the best ways to improve productivity is to boost trade. And I think trade in services amongst the advanced economies is a route which needs to be pushed further and farther than it has been so far.
Mervyn King, Lord King, governor of the Bank of England for 10 years, 2003 to 2013. His book is called The End of Alchemy, Money Banking and the Future of the Global Economy. Lord King, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you very much.
Final note on the way out today, it's going to be quick because we're tight on time. From the Economist Intelligence Unit, the top 10 global risks. Number one is a hard landing for the Chinese economy. You skip down a bit. Number five is the entire Eurozone falling apart. Number six is Donald Trump winning the presidential election in this country. You can check out the whole list for yourself. We have the link, of course, on our website, marketplace.org. All right, I said this was going to be quick. We're tight on time. The Dow, the NASDAQ, and the S&P 500 all up today. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. And wait, what? Oh, yeah, this is 8 p.m.